It was like a Sunday, and I woke up, and it was, my mom doesn't often bring me the newspaper because I was a kid. I didn't really want to read the newspaper, but one day she did, and I flipped through it, and I remember they said they had a city council meeting on the next week, and I was like 14, and I just wondered, what does a city council do? So I said, Mom, when you get off work, can you drive me to a city council meeting? And luckily, my mom is, and I are on the same page about a lot of things. So she was like, yeah, sure, I'm going to drive my 14-year-old to a city. Of course that's going to happen. And I attend, and then I go in, and being so straightforward with you, I remember thinking, my town is about 50-50 Black and white. Mm-hmm. And we don't, unfortunately, have a lot of other racial and ethnic diversity. But when I walked in that room, it was me, 14-year-old little Black girl, and everyone else in there was 65 plus, not minimum 65 years old white guy. And I just remember being very confused about that, because if our town is 50-50, why aren't 50-50 represented in city government?
Hi guys, and welcome back to Playground. On this episode, I have with me Ebony Freeman, who is the founder of Wonder Stars of the Universe, which is a podcast, a book, and a website. Ebony, how are you doing today?
I am better now. Happy to see ya.
Of course. Yeah, we had some little technical difficulties getting this Zoom back on, but it's working now, so grateful for that. How has, I guess, the past year been living in the pandemic, ever since the pandemic started? How has it been to transition from normal life to pandemic life?
Yeah, good question. I'd say at the beginning, I was definitely one of those people that was thrilled to be working from home. I've never worked remotely, and it was amazing because you don't always have to wear socks. You can put socks on your hands if you feel like it for a moment. You know, there's just so much freedom in working remote.
Yeah. I was a student during the pandemic, so it's a different experience for me. I kind of appreciated going to class, and in class, doing schoolwork on Zoom is not ideal at all. Just I guess to start off the interview or the podcast, where is home for you, and where did you grow up?
Yeah, where did I grow up? I grew up in Griffin, Georgia, a super small town almost smack dab in the middle of Georgia. And home has always been wherever I lay my head. I feel very comfortable in most spaces, and I can make a home with just about any place and just about anyone.
Okay, I like that. Wherever you lay your head, so that, I guess, alludes to sleeping, or like being able to comfortably sleep anywhere. I guess in that sense, what homes do you have around the world? Like, could you name off some homes you have around the world where you feel comfortable to lay your head down?
Ooh, so top two that came to mind are definitely this little tiny hotel in Kaohsiung, Taiwan. Wow. It was just so comfortable in the sense that every time I woke up and I walked outside my room, I saw a smiling face. And although I don't actually speak any Taiwanese, Mandarin, or Cantonese, so nothing that would be useful over there, it felt so easy to communicate with people. And that's definitely a home for me. And then the other place is this disgusting little hostel in Maui, Hawaii. It is filthy. I won't say their name because that would be rude, but they're disgusting. But I felt very comfortable there because, again, everyone was so friendly. And I felt like every time I looked out my window, there were these beautiful vistas of water and sunshine and these nice trees. But then when I closed my eyes, I was terrified that a spider or something would crawl on me. So it was definitely a mixed experience out there.
What were you doing in Taiwan and Hawaii? Were you just like vacation spots, or were you like working there, or yeah?
Yeah, for Taiwan, I was visiting my friend in Singapore. Okay. And I didn't think it made sense to buy a flight from the US to Singapore to only just go to Singapore. I needed to stop somewhere along the way to make that price worthwhile. And then with Hawaii, I just wanted to go back to Hawaii. My dad's in the military, and he had been stationed in Hawaii when I was in high school. And it's very different being there as an adult than a kid. Mm-hmm. Under my parents' supervision. So it was super fun to be able to wake up at 3 p.m. and really experience Hawaii the way I wanted to.
Okay. That actually kind of leads up to my next question, which is, what did or do your parents do for a living?
Yeah, so my dad was Army up until just a few years ago, and now both of my parents are teachers.
Oh, wow. Okay. So I'm assuming as a child, because your dad was in Army, did you travel a lot from like place to place, wherever he was stationed, or because that's like whenever I think of army kids, that's like the vision I have. Like that's what I think of. Is that correct or no?
Well, my dad was 4 times Afghanistan and 3 times Iraq, so I did not travel over there with him pretty often. When he was stationed in Kentucky for a bit, I visited him there, so I didn't travel with him. My mom and I and our family stayed in Georgia, but I did like to visit him wherever he was stationed that was available for me to visit.
Okay, of course. And what are your parents teaching? You said they were teachers. What did they teach?
Yeah, my mom was a general ed special education for the longest time. I think that's part of the reason I care so much about accessibility and making sure disability inclusion is at the heart of all product and program development, because my mom taught those students and I saw firsthand how difficult that could be if people just weren't thinking of you unnecessarily. And so, yeah. Okay. And then my dad teaches English, I believe. Yeah, high school English.
I like that. I like that, because teacher is a great profession and like giving back to future generations. I think education is crucial. So props to your parents for like being teachers. Yeah.
Thanks.
I guess what were you? So living in Griffin, Georgia. What were you curious about as a child? What like made brought you joy as a child? What were you just like curious about and really wanted to learn more about?
Oh, that's such an interesting question. I feel like it's tough because I was curious about everything and I had and still to this day, to some degree, I'm a little more refined, but I get really interested in something and deep interest for a short period of time and then I move on. Mm-hmm. And so my curiosity definitely for a while was trees and just the fact that you can have a grandmother tree that's been around for 100 years and every tree around it is getting nutrients from that one tree that's been here the longest. And then it was also, you know, local government. How does a city run? And why does my mom have to pay a fee when she parks in the wrong spot? Like that's kind of a weird thing. Like, there are certain places you could park this large metal thing that we drive around. Like this is the whole present day 21st century is kind of strange. And just trying to understand why the world is the way it is.
Okay. That's okay. I want to talk about Boden and more deeply first, but talking about trees. So I've never actually thought about this, and something that I guess now that you bring up, it is kind of like mind-blowing that these trees have been here for ages before us. And if they could tell stories, like the stories that they could tell, like the things that they have seen, like unimaginable. And how, like you said, how the old is the grandma tree is the nutrition, that gives nutrition for the future trees. Any thoughts about that? Or like what attracts you to these trees? Why were you thinking about these trees? What do you think like caused that curiosity in the first place?
Ooh.
If you could pinpoint anything, but if not, that's okay. Because yeah,
I think the very beginning of it might have been around third grade when I was starting to learn about genetics and how there are inherited traits. And we mainly learned about it like with mice and frogs and hair color and eye color. But I couldn't help thinking the fact that I can get a different colored apple if I mix different types of apple genes and different peas and carrots and the food that goes into my body. There's so much science behind it. And there's also some beautiful philosophy to some degree, because we're actively imposing our will upon these trees to a degree. They wouldn't necessarily have led to these different variations without our interactions and our input. And I just wonder how the different ways that trees impact us, because, you know, we eat apples from them and we get all these different, you know, lemon trees and everything. And then we're literally putting their fruits into our body.
Yeah.
Like they could kill us if they really thought it through. And, but then the same thing, you know, we have saws and we kill them, we tear them down so we can make paper. You know, it's just a weird relationship we have with nature. And I think that it's one of the most beautiful relationships, but also, so as you mentioned, curious.
Yes. Okay. That's that. I'm going to pinpoint that and I want to bring that back into the conversation later on. But I like that, like our relationship with nature and like essentially personifying nature here and giving nature a character and using that character in a relationship with human beings. Not many people think of it like that. And I think that's very unique that you were able to think about it like that as a child itself. But the next thing, you mentioned the local government and how a city works. So that's like kind of the exact opposite of nature. Like these are rules that we kind of impose on society ourselves. What got you, I guess, curious with that? And I know you mentioned the story about like the parking ticket, like sitting, like parking on the wrong side of the road. Like, has anything else like made you curious about it as a child, or do you have any little stories like that?
Yeah, city, that you're right though, it is kind of the office. Oh, yeah. I never thought about that. I'd say definitely parking tickets were the first big commute, because I love my mother. She's gotten some parking tickets in her day. Yeah. And I just kept being confused as to why the government will want more money from her after all the taxes that she pays. And then as a teacher, you know, half her salary is going to the students when she buys extra crayons, extra erasers. And I'm like, seriously, you want to take more of her check? And so that was a big thing. But then also my grandma worked in customer service in my local city government. So I just, and you know, both of my parents worked in some degree at the federal and state level of government. So my family's just always been civil service oriented. And I'd say the most poignant story from my childhood is probably, I remember it was like a Sunday and I woke up and it was, my mom doesn't often bring me the newspaper because I was a kid. I didn't really want to read the newspaper, but one day she did. And I flipped through it and I remember they said they had a city council meeting on the next week. And I was like 14 and I just wondered, what does a city council do? So I said, Mom, when you get off work, can you drive me to a city council meeting? And luckily my mom is, and I are on the same page about a lot of things. So she was like, yeah, sure. I'm going to drive my 14-year-old to a city. Of course that's going to happen. And I attend and then I go in, and being so straightforward with you, I remember thinking my town is about 50-50 black and white. And we don't, unfortunately, have a lot of other racial and ethnic diversity. But when I walked in that room, it was me, 14-year-old little black girl, and everyone else in there was 65 plus, not minimum 65 years old white guy. And I just remember being very confused about that, because if our town is 50-50, why aren't 50-50 represented in city government? So then I came home and I said, Mom, this is messed up. And she said, yes, you're right. What are you going to do about it? From there, I applied for an internship and became my city's first intern. And that was really cool. Since I was a child and they had never had an intern before, it was a very funny internship. Effectively, every week, a different department lead would say, hey, she's going to follow you around and ask questions. And that was my internship. But I learned a lot about what a city means, what a city does, and how cities arrive at this point where they don't represent their citizens very well. And now I'm happy to kind of push back against that narrative and help change that as the vice chair of the Boulder Arts and Culture Commission now.
Beautiful, beautiful. Like, brings it all together in a circle. And I guess, so I've done many interviews and I think this is the first time I've actually seen someone take action on their curiosity. And like, cause you were curious about the city, city rules, and you actually started interning there. I love that story that you mentioned. I'm just curious, what questions did you like ask these officials as like a 14-year-old black girl to like these, like I'm assuming older white individuals, what questions did you ask? And what were you like trying to get at?
Yeah. You know, the experience I most remember.
Yeah.
I can't help but laugh because it is a little farcical that I was just like following all these people around on their day job. Just, you know, this is a normal thing to do in the summer as a 14-year-old. But I remember I was in the car with the director of Parks and Rec, and we were just driving around, and I remember we were seeing subcontractors tear down branches. And I remember asking, why do we have to tear down branches? Shouldn't we let trees grow? Good trees. Trees are big to me. But shouldn't we let trees just do what they want to do with their lives? And they were like, no, Ebony, if a tree branch falls and hits someone, we could be sued. And I do remember that specifically, because there was an element of not really worrying about the person who just got hit by a tree branch. It was more so the fact that they could be sued. And I think it was so many different elements of that have to be considered at the city government level. It's not just caring about your citizens, unfortunately, it's also caring about the organization and what happens to the organization and protecting it. And there's a lot to city government, and I'm excited to learn more more and more every day.
Okay, I have more questions that come off of that too. I guess, so I'm pretty interested in changing systems and how to change systems and culture, especially culture. And I've talked to many individuals about this, and two pathways that I learned about is changing systems to government and changing systems or culture to business. And then the government is with public policy, like bringing policy changes, doing law, doing politics, that kind of stuff. And in business, the example I was given was just like changing how, if like Facebook, Google, or like one of these big organizations change how they treat their employees, they give more leave for maternity leave, et cetera, all the other companies would follow that, because that's the culture kind of thing. How do you have you, because if I remember correctly, you used to work at Facebook, right? Google.
I worked at Google for about 3 years.
Yes. So you've been in both of these kind of spaces. How do you think people can change cultures or systems in both of these spaces, in the government through policy or in business itself? Do you see any differences, any similarities, or do you see like a pros and cons to either of them?
That's a profound question. How do you change culture and systems in the public and private sector? Thank you so much. I feel like I'm doing a TED talk or I'm doing a thesis. This is massive. I'd say some of the most effective ways I saw culture change in the private sector with my work, not only as a full-time Googler, but also as a consultant for different tech companies, is it really does start at the grassroots level. It was always one person saying, I care today. And from there, moving on to get other people involved and having the heart to continue when people drop off or no one's interested for a while, but just deciding to care and deciding to continue to care. Because I remember, for example, with Accessibility Week at Google, I did organize the first accessibility and entertainment panel, which was one of the first panels we ever had that wasn't purely about technology. So I was bringing in directors and screenwriters and filmmakers who have disabilities or told the stories of people with disabilities. And that was the first time that happened. And we had a lot of interest from people who usually don't integrate with disability conversations. And the way it happened was just, I decided to care and I decided to hope to change something. And I saw that happen again and again across a lot of different spaces in the private sector. In the public sector, I really want to lie and say it's exactly the same. Grassroots efforts are the way to go. But in my personal experience, from what I've seen, it's just this really good quote. I'm not going to pretend to remember who said it, but it was like, think in centuries.
Okay.
And that a lot of government policy changes don't happen overnight. It's not one person thinking I care today. From what I've seen, it's more so one person who cared and got a lot of other people on their side and to their viewpoint, and then taking the time to just build on it incrementally over time. And just, I'd say more so for that one, it's about being willing to have delayed gratification.
And sometimes it's delayed gratification doesn't even occur in one's lifetime. Like after someone dies, like years, like you said, think in centuries. Like, yeah, that's profound. That's crazy. For me, like I guess I have some delayed gratification, but I want to see some like impact, some change happen in my own lifetime, something that I tangibly can touch. So it's different. And I appreciated what you said, but it reminds me of this one Big Sean song, one man can change the world. It was one of my favorite songs. And it talks about like what you said in a private sector. It starts with one individual having that desire. And I guess I do have a follow-up question to you is, so after you left Google, you had a desire to bring in that accessibility and panel and like bring in individuals with different disabilities and talk about your own experiences. Were you able to implement or like inspire others to have that desire as well after you left? Just like, is that still happening at Google? And for our listeners, because most of our listeners are early 20s, late teens individuals, how would you describe like finding one's desire, like finding one's area of what they want to change in the world, and how to like inspire others to also follow what they want to, not what they want to do, but like also inspire others to change the world as well? You get my question.
Yeah. So that's four questions. You're definitely going to have to repeat those along
yes,
the way.
Yes, I will.
So first, Dark Sky Paradise, one of the best albums yes. of all time. Okay, so what was your absolute last question? Then I'll work my way backwards.
Okay, yes. So my last question was, you mentioned like one person can change the world with that desire. So my last question was, so most of my listeners are early 20s, late teens. How can one understand what they want to change or what their desire is, and how can they influence others to also follow, like inspire others to go with their mission in that sense, to go with their desire to help implement change?
Yeah. So I'd say the way that I found my positive passions, and I add the adjective positive because I'm passionate about K-dramas, like Korean dramas. I love them, but that's not necessarily what I need to devote my life to. But my positive passions, the things that I want to make a positive impact on the world, all of them are rooted in, and this is where Playground is perfect, childhood experiences. So it was like, my stepbrother has autism, and I saw times where he was not treated equally because he was not able to communicate in the way that the other individuals would have rather received their communication. And that doesn't make him lesser. It doesn't make him worse. It was just different. And so accessibility has been in my core since a childhood because I just saw people being treated incorrectly. And I use that because it's not just unfair. It's not just unequal. It's incorrect. We're doing the wrong thing. And that's because of those childhood experiences. So I'd say a passion that's rooted in childhood experiences or things that you've cared about since you were a kid are easier to return to when things are tough. Because sometimes it's like, oh, I don't want to be interested in this. And I've definitely, and I'll be honest, like I've definitely had weeks, maybe a month or two of my life where I didn't want to care about accessibility anymore. It's hard work, but I still came back to it because I have cared about it for such a long time. And then how do you get other people to care as well? It's interesting because I've been told I'm really good at that. And it's funny because I don't understand how to convey it. I just get really, passionate about it. And I light up. And I think maybe one key piece of advice there is not holding back and letting your authentic passion, energy, exuberance for that topic come through. Because I do think that the times when I've tried to fake being passionate about something, like times when I had to fake being passionate about a data report, oh my gosh, it was awful for everybody in the room. But when I'm talking about accessibility, I can see other people's eyes light up because they're on that same wavelength. And so letting that good energy fully run through your body and then sharing it with others and not being afraid of looking wild or crazy, but just letting it fully out. Be a, what is it? Greta Thunberg,
the climate change.
European teenager who's like doing climate change right now. Like every time I see her, I always feel her passion from the TV. And so just letting that fullness of yourself come out.
Okay. I love what you said. And I want to just like chime in here because I don't think I knew that your stepbrother was autistic. I'm studying to become a doctor. I'm pre-med, but I want to become a pediatric neurologist. So a doctor for children with autism and developmental disabilities, because in my elementary school, I was one of my best friends had Down syndrome. And then like throughout elementary school, middle school, high school, I always like was with that population. I was always good friends with them, always making sure, trying to see how they perceive life and understanding how that, and like treating them as equals. And like, I enjoyed that. And I kind of want to give back to that society, that population. That's like pediatric neurologist kind of like combined it perfectly for me. So I'm happy, like accessibility, like it's also one of my biggest, I guess, passions too, because that's kind of what I want to address as a doctor one day, as a professional too. So it's something that's going to be intertwined in my daily conversations one day. Yeah. Just wanted that's to mention amazing. That. Yeah. Yes, that's of course with that. And then, so there's another question I have. You mentioned fake, like being fake passion, like having fake passions and then understanding what really is your authentic self and understanding what your authentic passion is and where it comes from. And I agree 100% with you that it does come from your childhood and you could get inspirations from your childhood. But something that I've noticed at college, talking with people my age, just talking with strangers I met on the street or talking to strangers on the internet, is that sometimes it's difficult to understand what your authentic passion is compared to what your fake passion is. And something that I've noticed is that individuals, including myself, I believe, we used to fake passions to please others, to please our parents, to please society, to please other human beings. Like I see this all the time with like research opportunities for pre-med, many individuals do things to get into med school, not because they're passionate about doing the things they want to do. I see that with research. They do research because that's the only position they got, not because they're passionate about that research project, but because if they do it and get a publication out, they have better chances of getting to med school. And for me, that's good, but I don't like that. I don't like that controlling me because I want to make like a clear distinction between my passions and I want to explore my passions. How, like, I feel like that line gets blurred very easily between fake and actual true. How do you differentiate between the two? I have different ways how I differentiate and I could speak to those, but how do you differentiate between the fake ones and the authentic true ones? And I guess that's a good question to start off with.
Yeah. So I'd say there's two parts. The first is about how do I know when it's the real passion? And the other is the utility of the fake passion. So knowing it's the real passion, in the last year or so, I've been reading a ton of Buddhist books and listening to podcasts and learning more about Jewish mysticism and just all these useful religious texts and theologies for better connecting with my body. Because I think our body is one of the best friends we can have, because our body will tell us so much. Like, to be so honest with you, and I know it might sound weird, but I feel a tingle in my fingers when I'm really happy. And I feel it in my fingers. And so I know that I'm in the right space when I start to like move my fingers really fast. I can feel all that good energy. And so that's like the connection to my body, I think, helps me distinguish when something's a real passion, because I can feel it. And then I'd say, though, with the utility of fake passion, because I agree, there's definitely, I know a ton of people, and I've definitely been that person who took on an opportunity because it looked good, not because it felt good. But I think that kind of even rolls back to what we were talking about earlier and thinking in centuries, because I don't know if you can accomplish all your generational goals and legacy goals if you're only doing things that make you happy. Obviously, that you should, greater than 50% of your life should be the happiness, because that'd be just sad. And I think it's good to put as much happiness in your life and go with as many passions as you can. But I've definitely taken on research roles and projects, like specific projects at work, that don't make me happy. In fact, they make me kind of sad, but I learned a ton. Like, I learned a new skill, or I got to work with different types of people, and I learned a different work style by working with different types of people. So I think that it doesn't always feel good, but it might be good for you, like medicine.
Yeah. And it's, I guess what you're bringing back is looking at everything with a positive perspective, like seeing what you could gain out of every single experience.
You know, people keep telling me that I'm a very positive person. I get a positive spin on things. I see it as realism, but I like that people think I'm positive. I don't feel very positive. I'm just like, this is the way it is. You're just going to get a positive thing from it, even if it sucked the rest of the day.
So your optimism is other people's realism.
Yes, my realism is
other people's optimism. Yeah, your realism. Yeah, I got to say, your realism is other people's optimism. That's funny.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's a good like way to live, I guess, still. Like, yeah, you get something out of every single experience. And I guess, so what is your current role right now, and what do you do in Boulder? I know you mentioned it briefly before, but like, what is it exactly that you do?
That question was so much easier to answer when I worked at Google. Uh-huh. I would just say, I'm a solutions consultant. People are like, ooh, cool. And that'd be the end of the conversation. But now it's this whole spiel. So I'm the creative director of the Ebony Freeman Institute and the founder of Wonder Stars of the Universe. The Ebony Freeman Institute is an umbrella organization for how I help myself and other artists capitalize on their talents, monetize their intellect, and scale their impact. Just came up with that on the spot. Gonna write it down right after.
That sounds pretty good. Yeah.
Thank you. And then Wonder Stars of the Universe is my book series that I've written over the last 3 years, and the name of my podcast. And it's where the way I always describe the workshop that I do with Wonder Stars of the Universe is that when I was writing my book, my autobiography, I realized I couldn't tell the story of my own life without better understanding the impact of other people on my life. And so Wonder Stars are people who've had a profound impact on you, whether that's positive or negative, because there are people who've had a profound impact on you that's negative, and you benefit when you recognize that and take it in and accept it. So Wonder Stars of the Universe is all about helping people dive into their own stories using experiences and vignettes of experiences with other people to better understand their past, present, and future.
How did you come up with the name Wonder Stars of the Universe?
Mm-hmm.
How did you come up with the name? How did you, yeah.
Oh. I love to give a profound story. Like, I was sitting on a canoe in the middle of a lake. But I truly think I was like showering.
Yeah.
And I thought Wonder Stars, and then I like scrubbed my hair, and then I said of the universe, and then I put it together, and it was great.
That's beautiful. And I actually, yeah, so this is interesting that you mentioned. So are you currently writing the autobiography, or have you already written it? You said it's like a three-part series of your book.
Yeah, so it's already written and available on Amazon as an ebook, and I'll be recording the audiobook this winter. And so you'll find that on Audible soon. But I self-published both parts of the ebooks, and then the podcast is on Spotify, Apple, and everywhere else you find podcasts.
Okay. How is the experience of writing an autobiography? So I feel like for me and like for many individuals, like the process of writing is like therapeutic. It helps us like heal stuff and like heal our wounds and whatnot. And it helps me reflect and ponder and think. I think by writing, essentially. That's one of the modes, I think. So I can't even imagine writing an autobiography. And I feel like all the little like, yeah. So how was the experience of writing your autobiography? Yeah, then we can start off there.
Yeah. So the experience of writing my autobiography, it was kind of like going to Zaxby's. They have really good fries, mm-hmm. and ordering way too many fries. And it was good. It was delicious. But by the end of it, you're just like disgusted, even though it still tastes good if you're being honest with yourself. And I use that analogy because at the beginning, it was so wild and fun. And like, I'm writing these fun stories. And I got a lot of positive feedback at the beginning. I think that helped a lot. People were like, oh my gosh, it was so funny. I was laughing the whole time. And I was like, really? This was my life. but along the way, there were sadder stories and having to reckon with my actual feelings. So there are definitely those times where, again, wonder stars are the people who had the profound impact on your life. A lot of times I would start out not with a story idea, but a person in mind. And then I'd write a story based on experience with them. And it helped me uncover some feelings that I just hadn't been dealing with. Sometimes for years, I hadn't been dealing with those feelings, but you know, there was some tears shed, some hearty laughs, some gross, uncomfortable moments of like, oh my gosh, I did that, or oh my gosh, they did that. But then I'd say for each and every story within a few weeks or sometimes a few months, just depending on the processing time, I felt more whole and more like myself. And I think it empowered me to be able to live the more creative lifestyle that I have now.
Okay, that's a beautifully said answer. And that kind of makes me wonder, like, just the power of thinking back to your past and writing these stories. How do you choose which stories to share and which stories not to share? Do you share, like, do you choose, or like, does it come naturally? And I guess this is a nagging question I've been always wanting to ask an individual who's written an autobiography. I didn't know you wrote one, so here comes the question. How do you, like, if you, do you remember every single thing as it happened, or do you fill in the missing like gaps? Like, you know, this happened and then that happened, but you had no idea. You forgot what happened in between. Do you fill in those gaps? How does like the story work in that sense for memories that you don't know like the exact details of? Because I read like many memoirs, autobiographies, and the detail is very like intricate. And I'm surprised, like, I wouldn't even know this much detail about my childhood or like this time in like elementary school or middle school. How do you write like that?
Great questions. I'll answer the last one and then I'll roll back to the first one. You'll have to remind me when we get there. So the secret of autobiography is that you might put one name on the cover, but there's actually 800 names behind it. And so I include a acknowledgement section for sure in my book. I also put a disclaimer that it is my memories as I remember them. Feel free to write your own book if you have different memories, because I'd say that sometimes the details are quite specific. Luckily, I have some great editors, i.e. my grandmother and my mom. They're wonderful. And I also, when appropriate, wasn't afraid to reach out to the people who were in the stories and say, hey, I just wrote this. Do you mind reading it? And I'll admit, I've been told before I released it, but in some of the first editions, I would reach out to people and be like, hey, you know, I just wrote the story. Would you mind reading over? They're like, Ebony, that's absolutely not how it happened. And then they'll be like adamant about it. And then I'll be like, are you sure? And they'll show me pictures to prove that what I remembered was incorrect. And then I'm just like, I reach out to my friends who are NBB or neurobehavioral biology. And I'm like, hey, so just want to let you know for your own little research, I completely misremembered my entire life. You're welcome. And so, but I'd say just reaching out to other people and making and double checking some facts. But then I'd say the beautiful part about an autobiography, especially when you're talking about your life and not just your work, is that a lot of times what you're writing is your feelings. And you almost can't misremember your feelings. Because even if you didn't feel that exact way then, you feel that way right now when you're writing it. So it's still honest, which is kind of a beautiful thing and discovering your own feelings in real time.
Okay. That's beautiful that answered my question, because I was always curious about that. But I like how you said like the feelings are the ones that matter, and the feelings kind of ground the story, and the stories revolve around those feelings. And you may misinterpret or not remember exactly how the story works, but the feeling is there. I was also in NBB, so neuroscience and behavioral biology at Emory. So I know what you're talking about, exactly false memories and like the psychology of that. And like, there's so many psychology experiments that talk about how like this one famous one with false memories, where the researchers told they basically implanted the false memory of being lost in a mall to these kids, because many kids, even if they haven't been lost in a mall, they feel like one time in a lifetime they had been, and they make up a whole story about being lost in a mall. Like it's a false memory, but like your mind easily grasps onto these memories. So just another very big topic I'm very interested in, very good discuss another time, is the brain and how the brain functions. But yeah, beautifully said. We're kind of nearing the end of the podcast, so I just have like a couple of more last questions before we wrap it all up. This question is a little bit hypothetical. So if you could travel back in time and meet your child self, so little Ebony, what advice would little Ebony give you for the person you become today? So not what advice would you give her, but what advice would she give you based on her perspective, her childlike perspective of the world?
Play outside more.
I love that.
I definitely watch a lot of Netflix on my couch, and I could do for playing outside some more.
Okay. What did you use to play outside as a child? Like, what games did you use to play? Do you remember?
I definitely played a lot with my cousins, just pure tag and freeze tag. But then for myself, I'd sometimes just like follow a cloud. I would definitely go into neighbors' yards like an unreasonable amount of time. I just be, I'm following a cloud. My mom like, Ebony, that cloud is gonna go into a different state. You can't follow it.
That's so funny. I've never heard of it before, but I want to do that now. Follow a cloud. Yeah. That's because that childlike imagination, like seeing the cloud falling, just keep on going. That's amazing. Then one last question to wrap it all up. What is your favorite childhood movie and or book, and why?
Favorite childhood movie, definitely Matilda.
Mm-hmm.
Favorite childhood book. Bridge of the Arbithia might not be my favorite, but it was definitely very impactful. And I'd say the Matilda, because it was a very smart girl who got into a good deal of trouble that she didn't think was justified, which is the definition of my childhood. And then Bridge of the Arbithia was just two very conscious children who were trying to do interesting, fun things and be good people. Even at a young age, they were trying to be good people. And I really aligned with that.
All right. Beautiful. I think I see Matilda, and I read the book Matilda, and I heard of the other one, Bridge of Terabithia.
Yeah, Bridge of Terabithia.
Terabithia. I heard of that, but I checked that one out for sure. But yeah, thank you, Ebony, for being on this podcast and like answering my questions. Do you have any last minute snippets, or do you have any questions for me? Do you want to end off with, or anything you want to say to the audience before we end the conversation?
Oh, last thing for the audience, find and love your Wonder Stars. And then my last question for you is, what's your favorite book and movie as a kid? I'm really curious.
Yes. Favorite movie, I already mentioned, it would be Pirates of the Caribbean, because I always liked adventure and just like that feeling of finding something that might not be there, like treasure, or like going into uncharted territory. And like the ocean, like the sea breeze, like being on a ship and waking up on a ship, that just amazes me. So Pirates of the Caribbean for sure, and like how like the lore and the mythology, how I work with that, be my favorite childhood movie. Favorite childhood book. I have so many. Like I always, people ask me this and I give them different answers all the time.
Yeah.
But let me think. I want to get a good one for this one. Okay, it's not really childhood. It's more like middle school. But it's Count of Monte Cristo, which is a book by Alexandre Dumas, who also wrote The Three Musketeers. And The Count of Monte Cristo is like a fiction adventure book set in the 1800s in France. And I loved it because of the adventure element to it. Same thing with Pirates of the Caribbean. it's just very adventurous, and they like lived their lives in that book. And I kind of wanted to be in that book as well and like live my life. I feel like my life is somewhat boring compared to like the Three Musketeers, or like the count's life, and how he went to jail, he came back, and like he sought out revenge because he was wrongfully put into jail. So he sought out revenge on the people who put him into jail without spoiling anything. But like how the plot thickens, how the plot like progresses. Very good book. It's my favorite novel for sure. And the adventure element to it really wraps it all up for me. So I'm really attracted to adventure books, adventure movies, stuff that allows my imagination to play, because I feel like I'm living pretty boring life compared to what people in the past used to live, or people in these fantasy worlds live. So I always like, it's like my escape kind of thing. Adventure for sure.
Yeah. Oh, that's amazing. I've only read Count of Monte Cristo once, mm-hmm. and it didn't turn out well for me the first time. I will try again. Thank you for inspiring me.
Of course. Beautiful. Yes. Yes. So hold on. Yeah. Thank you, Ebony, for being on this, for having this conversation. It was a great conversation to have. And for our listeners, if you want to hear more, or if you enjoyed this conversation and want to hear more, please, please, please subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, and you can follow us on Spotify as well. And yeah, I'll see you guys next time.